To also, the Portland Association of Teachers has ratified the contract deal that averted an unprecedented walkout. And now that the union members gave the go-ahead on this negotiated settlement, I didn't say arm twisting, did I? No, I didn't. The deal now heads to the school board month for votes tonight. This should be exciting. In the road from Damascus and Imbroglio, Damascus, the town nearby, gets what it wants. And as the saying goes, sometimes karma is getting what you want and then getting stuck with it. After months of harsh controversy, the Oregon Senate finally approved a bill allowing property owners on the edge of Damascus to leave the city. And guess what? That's what they're doing. So now property owners within a half mile of another existing city can de-annex from Damascus, likely leading to many residents who qualify to annex into nearby Happy Valley. Maybe Right to Dream 2 can move to Damascus as it's gradually vacated. We have weather to get to. It's sunny today, but it won't be that way for very long. And I would much rather hear from Richard Stallman. So that said, and on that note, I want to greet one of the most extraordinary guests we've ever had on the show. Good morning, Richard. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, it's that morning here in
Good
Cambridge,
afternoon. Good day to you. Good day. Well,
hello. Can
yes.
you hear me?
Yes.
It's not morning here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's 1 p.m. But something more important, I have to correct the way you introduced me, because I did not write our encryption and decryption code. We have a program called the GNU Privacy Guard, or GPG, which is part of the GNU operating system, the overall project that I launched. But the GNU Privacy Guard was written by Werner Koch. And he deserves the credit for that.
Thanks for clearing that one up. There are a lot of misunderstandings out there, and that's exactly why we invited you. I wanted so much to have you on the show today. First off, the free software movement. I'd like you to talk a bit about that, and I am curious as to why we don't talk about the free software movement as much as we perhaps ought to or understand it.
Well,
instead, the dialogue seems to have migrated over to open source. How did that happen? Why are we in the...
First, I better explain what free software
yes.
means. Free software is free as in freedom. We're not talking about price. We don't mean it's gratis. That's a detail that we don't let distract us. Question is whether the software respects users' freedom and community or not. With software, there are two possibilities. Either the users control the program or the program controls the users. Free software is the first case where the users control the program. Now, in order for that to be so, there are certain freedoms that the users need to have. There are four essential freedoms, and those are the criteria for free software. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish for whatever purpose. Freedom one is the freedom to study the program's source code, which are the mathematical-looking plans through which the program was written. So you have got to be free to study those plans and then change them to make the program function for you the way you want it to. Well, these two freedoms are enough to give one user, individually or separately, control over the program, but that's not sufficient. Part, obviously, because most users are not programmers. Most users don't know how to study and change source code. So if you're only given control separately, it's not enough. We also need collective control, which means that any group of users are free to work together to maintain their control over what the program does. Now, this requires the other two essential freedoms. Freedom number two is the freedom to make exact copies and distribute them to others when you wish. Now, that could be giving them away or selling them. It's up to you and the other people. And freedom three is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions to others when you wish. So you can see that with those two freedoms, the members of any group are free to work together, making the program do what they want it to do, and also free to offer copies of their version to the public. So this way, the users control the program, and they control the computing that they do with this program. And that's what really matters. Of course, if you're doing computing, you deserve to have control over it. But if the users don't have these four freedoms, if any of them is missing or partly missing, so it's not sufficient, then the users don't entirely control that program. So the program at least partly controls the users. And the owner or developer controls the program. So what have we got? We've got a system of unjust power. The owner of the program controls the program, which controls the users. So that owner has power over the users. This is why every non-free program is an injustice, because it creates unjust power. And of course, the owners, developers, they know how much power they've got. In fact, they've carefully studied just how far they can get away with pushing that power in order to gain further advantages over people. And they do this by putting in malicious functionalities that spy on the user, or functionalities that intentionally restrict what the user can do with the program, or functionalities known as backdoors, where the owner can send a command to the program telling it to do something to the user without asking the user for permission, without even informing the user, perhaps. And it doesn't matter whether the users like this or not. They can't stop it. Now, 30 years ago, when I started the free software movement, maliciousness was rare. That was shocking. You know, the proprietary software developers didn't respect your freedom, but you could pretty well expect that at least they were being honest and not making their program intentionally to hurt you. But nowadays, the ethical standards have fallen, and it's normal practice to make non-free programs malicious. For instance, one package that has all of those three kinds of malicious functionality that you might have heard of is called Microsoft Windows. Windows is literally malware because it's designed with spy functionalities. It's designed with DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, which is a functionality to intentionally restrict what users can do with the data they've got. And it has a universal backdoor. A universal backdoor means that Microsoft can use this backdoor to change the software. It can install any changes whatsoever. So any malicious feature that's not in Windows today could be remotely installed by force tomorrow. So Windows is not just malware, it's universal malware. Other packages you've heard of that are known to be malware, they have specific known malicious functionalities, include macOS, iOS, which is the system of the iThings, Flash Player, Angry Birds, the PlayStation 3, the PlayStation 4, the Xbox, the Amazon Swindle, and nearly all portable phones. Now, I could give you the details, but probably we should move on. But
next time,
in free software, malicious functionality is rare. It's so rare that when you find out about any, it's shocking. And the reason this is still the case in free software, although malicious functionalities are rife in proprietary software, is that with free software, the users have control. And if they find something malicious, they can take it out. And the developers, the contributors, know this. We know that if we contribute to free software, that doesn't give us any power. It's not supposed to give anybody power over anybody else. And it doesn't. So we know that you can fix whatever we do if you don't like it. And as a result, we don't feel the same kind of temptation. Power corrupts, and we don't have power, so we generally don't get corrupted.
Richard, we are almost out of time. I wish that we could hear a great deal more from you. I'd like to invite you back any time, any day, any weekday,
well,
1 p.m.
Well, just write to me and tell me specifically when.
I'll call about that and set it up so it's convenient for you.
I can make canoe.org for more information.
Please give us that. Please give listeners any information you want them to have. Where can they find out more about the free software movement and everything?
Canoe.org/philosophy and canoe.org/help.
And of course, listeners can Google the free software movement and find out a lot more about what's going on. That
or you could search for it with DuckDuckGo, which says it doesn't track you.
Yeah.
Where Google says it does track you.
Thank you so much for that. I cannot thank you enough. We've been speaking, of course, with Richard Stallman, and this has been Air Cascadia for Friday, February 28th, 2014. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Tune in to A Different Nature Monday, March 3rd from 8 to 10 p.m. for a preview of March Music Moderne for 2014. March Music Moderne celebrates 20th and 21st century music with 32 events from Friday, March 7th through Sunday, March 16th at venues throughout Portland. Joining us will be March Music Moderne's founder and organizer, Bob Priest, for a full rundown on what's to come. That's A Different Nature, Monday, March 3rd from 8 to 10 p.m. More info on March Music Moderne at the KBOO homepage under Community Events or at marchmusicmoderne.org.
Today on Flashpoints, we'll feature an update on the situation in Ukraine as Russia weighs in with military exercises. We'll have our weekly report on occupied Palestine with Nora Barros-Friedman and the electronic intifada.net. And the Biggs Beat offers a bit of a different perspective on the recent veto of anti-gay legislation in Arizona. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue our drumbeat coverage of the situation in Kyiv. What is going on there? We've now seen the Russians weigh in. They have exercises going now. Apparently a message to the West. Joining us to talk about what is happening there, get some background, is David C. Speedy. He is the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. Mr. Speedy, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. Good. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. First of all, you say in simple terms, half the people in Ukraine look to Russia and the other half look to the West. Explain that, and then I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about Putin's response.
Of course, surely. Again, quite simply speaking, Ukraine is divided at least into two parts, East and West, although in my last visit there, I was told there are actually four Ukraines, East, West, South, Crimea, where much of the attention is focused today, of course, and Kyiv. So if you look at the map of the last elections, the last presidential elections, you will see that Ukraine is split basically in half. It's a little bit reminiscent of the red-blue divide in our country, but even more dramatic, where in the eastern and southern part of the country, you have huge majorities for Yanukovych, the president now in exile, supposedly in southern Russia, and in the west, western part of the country, equally large majorities for the opposition forces that are more basically pro-Europe, pro-EU. So it's a pretty stark, divisive, and volatile situation that is basically caused by this internal schism within one sovereign country.
And just say a little bit more about who seems to be in control in the moment? There was an emergency meeting of the parliament, some people say after many of the opposition or one side left town. Help us, just bring us up to speed on that.
Well, again, the word volatile comes to mind, Dennis, because really it could almost, the situation could change by the time we end this conversation. But basically what happened last week, of course, in Kiev, and there have been dramatic developments in both Kiev and now in the last day or so in Simferopol, the capital of Crimea. But in Kiev, basically there was an accommodation reached with Yanukovych and the leaders of the opposition, Mr. Klitschko and others, for a sort of interim, almost like sort of power-sharing agreement that would lead to early elections to succeed Yanukovych. The more extreme elements in the opposition, the armed opposition in the streets of Kiev and Maidan Square, basically tore up that agreement, and you know, that things went downhill very quickly from there. So the question of who's in charge really is the key question, and it's one that's almost impossible to answer. My view is that people like Klitschko and the newly appointed Prime Minister Yakutsev is interim Prime Minister, have never been in charge of what you'd call the Kiev street or the Ukraine street. It's been a pretty motley assembly of responsible opposition leaders, such as those two individuals and others, and some rather nasty extreme elements, including some very ultra-right-wing neo-fascist groups that have taken advantage of a situation. As one Russian official, I think not unjustifiably, said, it's difficult to look upon men dressed in black masks and wielding Kalashnikovs as genuine sort of democracy protesters. So it's a very dangerous, perilous, and rapidly changing situation.
Well, I guess the banning of Russian language in Ukraine didn't inspire Putin to try and get in the negotiating mood. Talk a little bit about what Russia's been doing. They've got military